Hello, I'm John Rossi, a touring drummer with a love of all things animal. When I'm on the road, I visit as many zoos, aquariums. Hey, wait a minute. What's going on? Hey, what's going on there? Hello? Hello?
We interrupt your regularly scheduled program to bring you Rossafari Zoo News. News you can use from the world of zoos and conservation. Every week, we bring you breaking news and analysis from around the globe, featuring the animals you love and the people who care for them. And here's your anchorman, John Rossi.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to Rossafari Zoo News, your look at everything going on in the world of zoos, aquariums, animal weirdness, conservation, all kinds of good stuff. I am your host, John, and I am here to take you through a bunch of stories. Now, we're going to start off talking about something that last week we ended up dedicating the entire Zoo News episode to. So if you haven't listened to last week's episode, you might want to go back and give that a listen, because we talked a lot about what's going on at the San Francisco Zoo right now, and I actually have a big follow-up on that coming. But I also talked about the fact that I got a new puppy named Buzz, and Buzz is currently hanging out on my lap as I record this. And this is the part of the podcast where I normally share what's going on with my life, but honestly, I'm just focused on Buzz in all my spare time right now. And I talked about him on Friday and Tuesday. So I guess I'll just let y'all know that if you haven't seen it yet, I did set up an Instagram for him at That'll Be The Day Buzz. And you can follow along if you want tiny dog content. But we actually have lots of Zoo News things to talk about since it's been 2 weeks since a normal episode. So before I get to that, real quick, just let me remind you to go ahead and hit subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. And, you know, make sure you follow along at Rossafari on the socials, at Rossafari Pod on the TikTok machine. And yeah. All right. Without anything else blathering on, let's get to it. All right, so holy crap, did I have an interesting day on Friday. After sharing my episode with y'all, I went to my volunteer gig at the aquarium, and as is often the case, I stayed off my phone until lunchtime. And as I decided to venture back into my cyber world, I discovered that a whole lot of people had listened and appreciated what I said about the problems at the San Francisco Zoo. Between Friday and Saturday, I think I heard from more people than I ever have about a Zoo News episode, including multiple current and former, but mostly current, keepers at the San Francisco Zoo. And every single one of them wrote to basically thank me for sharing what I shared or confirming the issues that I mentioned and confirming that they are very real and that my support was greatly appreciated, you know, stuff like that. I was actually shocked at how many people from the zoo I heard from, which was great, but yes, a little surprising. And then I also heard from many of you in my regular audience as well, because it turns out that the stuff I mentioned wasn't the only news from the San Francisco Zoo that day, as they announced that giant pandas would be coming to the zoo. Y'all, when I saw that announcement on the same day that my episode dropped, you could have knocked me over with a feather. You know, a whole lot of y'all wanted to know my opinion on the topic in light of the issues I discussed in the special edition last week. To be honest, I have a complex series of emotions about the whole thing. So I'm going to start off by saying that I heard rumors about this back when the president of China announced that giant pandas would be back in the States. He specifically stated that giant pandas would be returning to California, which everyone, including myself, took to mean that they would be returning to the San Diego Zoo. But I started hearing rumors almost immediately that it would actually be San Francisco that received the bears instead. So I quickly reached out to a few contacts in San Diego, confirmed that they were getting, panda bears again, and wrote the San Francisco rumor off as just that, a rumor. So then the leadership turmoil goes public, and the zoo announces pandas. And, okay, sure, I could be cynical and say that the zoo probably held on to the announcement until the Chronicle article broke to try to pull focus from the negative news. But, like, I can't definitively say the zoo did that, so I'll leave it up to y'all to decide. But as far as the zoo getting panda bears, I'm actually not upset about this, or at least not as upset as you might think, given last week's episode. So I've been to the San Francisco Zoo, and I've met a lot of the keepers and had some seriously long and deep discussions with a few. Like the good kind of discussions where we talk about training philosophies and enrichment ideas and all that good nerdy zoo stuff that I'm so into. And I really, really, truly think the keeper staff there does an amazing job. As a matter of fact, as I made clear in last Friday's episode, the main problem with the zoo is the disconnect between the upper management of the zoo and the incredible keeper staff. And y'all know which side of the battle I'm on there. So with the oversight China provides for their bears, coupled with the fact that the pandas are going to have incredible keepers, I truly believe the bears are going to a facility where they will get the absolute best care. And since the announcement also said the bears will arrive after a new habitat has been constructed for them, I also believe they will end up in a very good, very safe place. It was also pointed out to me recently that San Francisco actually has a huge Chinese population, so it seems like a very logical place for the bears to go to help build connections with that community and the zoo. And, I'm not going to lie. There is a part of me that thinks about the construction costs of a new state-of-the-art panda bear habitat and the $1 million per year cost that goes along with the panda loan. And I think, maybe that money could be used to fix a lot of the problems that they have at the zoo with the older buildings or to replace those buildings altogether. And that it could also be put towards raising, keeper salaries at the zoo. But honestly, from what I've heard about the amount of money zoos make off having panda bears at them, it's very possible that bringing these bears in will actually create a lot more revenue that could be used for those same purposes. So here's hoping that's what will happen with it. But the thing I'm the most concerned about is something that I talked about a lot last year, which is the large group of people. Are they real people? Are they bots? Are they influencers just doing it for money? Are influencers real people? I don't know. But what I'm talking about, of course, is the large group of online and in-person protesters who attacked every single zoo that had pandas, claiming they were abusing the bears and making horrible comments about the keepers and the conditions the bears were in and all that stuff. Now, I saw it first at the Memphis Zoo, and then it spread to the other zoos with pandas. And y'all, it got really bad and really vitriolic. And these were zoos like the National Zoo, the Memphis Zoo, places that don't have huge leadership issues right now with big journalistic investigations and tiny special editions of podcasts going after them. If those campaigns pick up steam again when pandas start coming back to the States, you can be sure they will do everything they can to attack the San Francisco Zoo for the problems it has had in the last few years. It actually worries me for the keepers and the social media people and really all the people who won't be shielded from it in the way upper management may actually be shielded. So that's my biggest concern about all of this by far. But before we move on, and we will, I promise, there was actually another press release from the San Francisco Zoo the same day that they announced pandas. It read, in its entirety, quote, "We are aware of the article, which misrepresented information and included many inaccurate facts. The San Francisco Zoo is certified by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums and regulated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which conducts unannounced inspections. For more than 25 years, we have regularly passed these inspections. We take the care of our animals very seriously, and we're one of a handful of zoos with dedicated animal behaviorists and wellness researchers on site to regularly evaluate the health and welfare of our animals. We also have numerous safety protocols to ensure the safety of our staff, as well as safety and welfare committees responsible for reviewing staff concerns, evaluating the situation, and resolving any issues. We are proud of the San Francisco Zoo and our teams, who work hard to make it one of the most popular destinations for the 700,000 people visiting our zoo annually." End quote. And immediately upon posting this statement, former keepers started commenting, detailing their concerns with the zoo. Now, I didn't see any current staff doing the same, but obviously that would be grounds for termination, so that makes sense. The accusations made by former staff both rehash what I discussed on Friday and also include stuff I hadn't seen before, such as the accusation that all DEI initiatives that were required to pass the most recent AZA accreditation visit were cut short right after they were granted accreditation. Now, I am not saying that is true, merely stating what was said by a former employee, and I was able to confirm that person was truly someone who used to work at the zoo. And keep in mind, these people speaking out are doing so using their real names. They're not, like, using burner accounts or anything. I saw this on both Facebook and Instagram. The comments were, by and large, well-written, not in the standard attacking someone on the internet kind of way you see many comments sections devolve into. I didn't really love the statement that they posted. For starters, and I know this is a quibble, but it says they are certified by the AZA instead of accredited by them. And again, I know it's a minor thing, but when addressing serious concerns, maybe get that bit of information, which is supposed to, like, you know, defend you, get it correct. And I also had to chuckle at the bit about being regulated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I mean, yes, they are, but so is every roadside zoo in the country. So were all the facilities run by the Tiger King people. And again, I'm in no way comparing the San Francisco Zoo to any of that stuff at all. But like, come on. But the part that really bothered me was when they said the article misrepresented information and included many inaccurate facts. The reason it bothered me was the Chronicle spoke to a whole bunch of former and current zookeepers, and I myself have now spoken to a bunch of former and current zookeepers, and they all confirm the facts and stories in that article. So in phrasing it that way, the zoo comes across, to me at least, as accusing their incredible keepers of lying. And I just don't see how that is going to help bridge the gap between management and the staff at the zoo. This one is really a mess, y'all. So I really hope the upper management of the zoo figures this out and soon. And to wrap this rant up, to all the keepers at the San Francisco Zoo that are listening, you are heard. You are believed, and you are appreciated, both for your transparency about the issues you face and for the absolutely incredible work you do, even when facing such a challenging situation daily, really. So, much love to all of you. Okay, hold on. So I'm actually jumping back in here. I know that was the end of my rant, but I was editing this episode, and holy beep. I just went back to the statement that I mentioned because I wanted to confirm I hadn't messed up my transcription of it. And it's gone now. Wiped from all socials. I don't know if that's because it was not a very good statement or because I wasn't exaggerating when I said that, like, former keepers had overrun the comment section about it. But, yeah, they took down their statement. This is officially a mess, y'all. Okay, and that brings us to our births for the week. All right, so one of the most exciting births recently has been that of a bat-eared fox at the Cincinnati Zoo. Born to ambassadors Bruce and Ivy, who you've heard about a lot on this podcast on some of the older Cincy ambassador episodes, the little one has actually gone on to be hand-reared by the Africa team, specifically the people who take care of the cheetahs at the zoo. He's amazingly adorable, and being friends with a lot of that team, I get to see a lot of cute bat-eared fox content right now, which is making me very happy. Another very exciting birth to discuss happened at the Brevard Zoo, where I recently mentioned a pregnancy announcement that has now come to fruition. The zoo announced the birth of two litters of white-nosed coatis, the first born in an AZA facility in North America in the past 7 years. Two different moms have given birth around the same time, with a grand total of 8 coatlets between them. The kits are doing well, and hopefully this marks a turning point for the breeding of the species in North America. And I should pause here and say that I do feel like there's a lot to catch up on this week, so we're going to be blasting through some of these, so no disrespect for the kiddos that have been born lately. But yeah, a blue duiker has been born to our friends at the Chattanooga Zoo, or Chattazooga. The little one, who is absolutely tiny and adorable, is named Beans. A Sichuan Takin has been born at Pottawatomie Zoo in Indiana. The father is named Caboose, which is a great Takin name, and the mom is Yi Liu, and she actually gave birth right on exhibit. Within 50 minutes, the little one was standing up on its own and nursing. What an amazing thing to get to see in person. That would be so cool. The Kansas City Zoo and Aquarium has announced the birth of 2 Arapaho goat kids, both of which instantly started to show very strong and distinct personalities. I'm sure it'll be fun watching them on socials. Zoo Tampa has announced the birth of 2 Inca tern chicks, 2 parents Mario and Daisy, a great reference to the Super Mario Nintendo games. The Memphis Zoo has announced the birth of a baby bongo, the hoofstock, not the drums. The baby is named Franny, and as is often the case with these, is pretty darn adorable. The Dallas Zoo has announced the birth of a baby giraffe that is doing well and bonding behind the scenes with mom right now. The Staten Island Zoo has welcomed 4 new meerkats, courtesy of parents Jasmine and Macadamia. All 4 are females and have been named after the Golden Girls, so they are Blanche, Rose, Sophia, and Dorothy. And Dorothy is nicknamed Dot, both because that is actually a common nickname for Dorothy's, and because she has a dot on her forehead. The Pueblo Zoo has announced the birth of a De Brazos monkey born to Ruby and Kanoa. Ruby has been doing so well being a mom that the zoo has managed to stay completely hands-off with the baby so far, which is always incredible to see. Our friends at the Nashville Zoo have announced the birth of a red ruffed lemur named Helios. All of the red ruffed lemurs at the zoo have names inspired by Greek mythology, and I'm a huge fan of Greek mythology, so I think that's pretty cool, not gonna lie. And then last but not least in the births section, Busch Gardens has announced the birth of a critically endangered Bornean orangutan that was delivered by C-section to Mother Luna. This was one of those situations where the zoo knew it could be a problematic birth, so they brought in experts from different medical and zoological communities to collaborate on the surgery and the plan for both mom and baby. I love seeing this kind of thing. And as a side note, if you've been at all interested in or a part of the zoological world for a while now, you've probably heard orangutans referred to as orangs. However, the SSP is trying to get people to stop doing that, It turns out that it's actually really offensive to refer to orangutans as orangs in the Malay language. It's kind of like calling them a person in the human sense of the word. It's one of those things that is kind of hard to explain when translating because we don't quite have the same exact words and meanings in English, but it is considered offensive to native speakers. So the movement is on to only refer to them as orangutans from now on. Now, I'm sure that I have used the two interchangeably on here before, especially in episodes dealing with orangutans, but moving forward, I'm going to stick to orangutan or some other goofy joke names that I'm sure I'll come up with during those episodes because my brain is a silly place. But yeah, I encourage all of you listening to do the same and, you know, not use a word that is offensive. The more you know and all that. And now that brings us to our deaths for the week. And we are starting with a couple of doozies, honestly. These first two hit home for me personally. The first one is the loss of Betsy, the 9-year-old red panda who lived at Millbrook's Trevor Zoo and who I got to spend a good amount of time with. Betsy was actually born at the Philadelphia Zoo before moving to the Central Park Zoo, where I visited her dozens of times over the years. Whenever I was gigging in or rehearsing in New York City, it always was just like a time of chaos. I don't know, going up there and doing what I do for a living is just always chaotic, even when it's fun and cool in other ways. But Betsy visits would help center me before going back into the crazy bustle of the city. Then, when she went to the Trevor Zoo, I got to actually hang out with her multiple times, and it was always so fun. She was sweet and a little shy at first, but then would open up and let you hang out and feed her and just kind of exist in her world. She was genuinely one of the sweetest pandas I've ever met. As I've mentioned, Betsy was 9 years old, which is fairly young for a panda in human care to pass. She was found unresponsive in her outside exhibit space, and no cause of death was found from the initial examination, though a full necropsy will hopefully shed some light on what happened. On one more personal note about Betsy, when the zoo shared about her passing, one of the photos they used was of me interacting with her, and it just meant so much to me to be able to see and relive that moment as I said goodbye. I'm so grateful for the incredible team at the Trevor Zoo for all they do for the animals in their care, and for how they foster hearts of conservation in the students that go there. What a cool and unique place. I'm sending all my love to the team and to all of the students there. Betsy, I miss you. This one hurts. And that's not the only panda we said goodbye to this week, as the Pueblo Zoo announced the unexpected passing of Scout. Scout had spent the majority of his 8 years at the Buffalo Zoo, where I got to know him right after I started falling in love with red pandas. Scouty Scout, as he was affectionately known to his keepers and fans, was a really fun panda who loved training. He was also one of the hardest pandas to get good photos of. Back when he lived in Buffalo, I would spend hours getting slightly blurry photos or pictures of him where he was out of focus while the leaves he darted behind were in focus. In a Buffalo Zoo fan group online, I actually saw other people commenting the same thing, and they are much better photographers at zoos than I will ever be. Scout was a very brave and curious boy, and it really hurts my heart that he's gone and that these two pandas have both recently passed away. Scout moved to Pueblo from the Buffalo Zoo back in September as part of a breeding rec for the SSP. He is so missed. Goodbye, little buddy. Zoo Atlanta has announced the passing of Chelsea, a 20-year-old female Sumatran tiger. She had chronic health issues, which included kidney disease, and once her issues progressed to the point they could no longer be managed, the decision was made to humanely euthanize her. Chelsea, who almost made it to her 21st birthday, was very old for a Sumatran tiger, which live 10 to 12 years in the wild and often to around 15 in human care. She will be missed, but I love seeing stories like this and knowing how incredible the golden years of the animal were. The Denver Zoo has said goodbye to Lisu, a 13-year-old clouded leopard. Lisu had numerous challenging healthcare issues that sadly moved past the ability to handle medically. So with a compromised quality of life, the correct decision was made to humanely euthanize her. One of the issues that Lisu faced was that she developed a severe allergy to several types of meat, which is, you know, a major issue for an obligate carnivore. The team at the zoo was able to quickly realize what was going on, and they were able to adjust her diet accordingly, giving her many, many more years than she would have had with the same issue in the wild. In fact, the life expectancy of a clouded leopard in the wild is 12 to 15 years, so Lisu actually made it to her golden years. Now, in human care, they can live up to 17 years, but the fact that she made it 13 with the allergy and all of her health conditions is a testament to the incredible work being done at the Denver Zoo. The oldest giant panda in Japan has passed away. Tian Tian, who lived at the Kobe Zoo, was being treated for heart disease at the time of her passing, and it is believed that she succumbed to this condition. Tian Tian was an older bear, like I mentioned, but was still adorable, and if you see photos, you will see what looked like a white beard hanging down, which, you know, again, not to overuse the word, but is pretty darn adorable. The Ramat Gan Safari in Israel recently said goodbye to Warda, a female elephant who was 66 years old. During her life, Warda gave birth to 8 calves, and she was absolutely beloved at her home in Israel. The Honolulu Zoo has announced the passing of Scruffy, a female sun bear. Scruffy spent most of her life at the Cleveland Metro Park Zoo, but moved to Hawaii for retirement in 2022. Scruffy's exact age is unknown, but she was at least 48 years old, making her the oldest sun bear in human care, almost doubling the life expectancy of sun bears in human care, which is 25 years old. What an incredible age for an incredible bear. Capron Park Zoo has announced the passing of Fred. Fred was a black and white Argentine tegu, a really funky looking species of lizard that I just love. He was at the zoo for the past 10 years after being removed from the Florida wilderness as an invasive species. And I know that I often talk about how most animal species aren't taken out of the wild for AZA-accredited facilities anymore, but since Fred was an invasive species, if there weren't zoos like Capron Park to take him in, he would have been removed and euthanized. Fred was particularly popular at Capron Park Zoo because his habitat was in the gift shop, giving guests a really unique experience and making him a star of the show at the zoo and a favorite amongst the humans on the gift shop team. What a cool thing to do, having a tegu say goodbye as you leave the zoo. Fred will be greatly missed. And last but not least in this section, the Topeka Zoo announced the untimely passing of Karen, a beloved ostrich at the zoo. Karen was a total goofball who loved swimming, playing in sprinklers, and dancing around her habitat, and the circumstances of her passing are really sad. Karen reached her neck beyond her exhibit fence to grab the keys of a staff member at the zoo and immediately swallowed them. Experts around the country were consulted on how best to intervene, and both surgical and non-surgical options were explored, but none of them were successful, and Karen passed away. The zoo announced that a thorough investigation was completed into the death, and that appropriate actions were being taken in regards to the staff member in question, and that zoo protocols would be reviewed and enhanced to ensure nothing like this ever happens again. What a heartbreaking story. I feel so deeply for the staff member involved. What a nightmare. There's nobody who is working at a zoo in any capacity, animal care or not, that doesn't absolutely adore the animals at the zoo. So I just feel so bad for them. Sending all my love to all the people at that zoo and all the zoos that have suffered such terrible losses. All right, so moving on from births and deaths, we get to the rest of our zoo news section. So remember the whole big top 10 zoos thing USA Today did that we talked about multiple times? And I talked about how weird it was that they didn't do aquariums this year? Well, apparently they are staggering them, so the voting for aquariums is now live. The nominees in alphabetical order are our friends at Adventure Aquarium in New Jersey, Audubon Aquarium in New Orleans, Downtown Aquarium in Denver, the Florida Aquarium in Tampa, Georgia Aquarium in Atlanta, Loveland Living Planet Aquarium in Draper, Utah, the Maritime Aquarium in Connecticut, Maui Ocean Center, the Aquarium of Hawaii, Monterey Bay Aquarium in California, Mystic Aquarium in Connecticut, the National Aquarium in Baltimore, the New England Aquarium in Boston, Newport Aquarium in Kentucky, but it's like right across from Cincinnati. Our friends Odyssey Aquarium in Scottsdale, Arizona, Ripley's Aquarium of the Smokies in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, our friends at Shedd Aquarium in Chicago, the Tennessee Aquarium in Chattanooga, the Texas State Aquarium in Corpus Christi, the Virginia Aquarium and Marine Science Center in Virginia Beach, and the Wonders of Wildlife National Museum and Aquarium, which is the one owned by Bass Pro Shops that is located in Springfield, Missouri. You can vote by following links on any of your favorite aquariums' social media pages. Right now, the top three in order are Audubon, Wonders of Life, and Adventure Aquarium. An incredible story out of the Columbus Zoo and the wilds, which is pretty exciting. It's all conservation-y. I love those. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine recently announced that the Ohio Wildlife Council has voted to remove the trumpeter swan from the state's threatened species list. The swan was nearly driven to extinction in the early 20th century, but over the last 3 years, a major reintroduction effort has been made, including the wilds reintroducing 154 birds into their native habitats over those 3 years. These birds joined with others to create breeding populations across the former homes of trumpeter swans, and now the population is over 900 strong and growing. What a huge conservation win for the species. And as a side note, this is one of those stories that I think is so important to remember when talking to the anti-zoo crowd. A lot of times when I have those conversations, they center around the fact that not many species that are truly extinct in the wild have been reintroduced thanks to zoos. And that is true, although the number is higher than most people realize. But part of the reason why it's not higher is that zoos step in before the animal goes extinct in the wild. Whether it's the California condor or trumpeter swans in Ohio or hellbenders all over and around the eastern U.S., the reason zoos don't introduce more extinct animals back into the wild is because zoos are working so hard to make sure the species don't go extinct in the first place. But moving on. The next two stories are all about the ingenuity involved in the lengths zoos go to for their animals. So we're going to start at the Central Park Zoo, where a 15-year-old king penguin named Will was treated for a foot wound that caused him discomfort while walking. Topical treatments didn't work as hoped, so the vet recommended a custom walking boot to fit over his foot. One of the seasonal associates at the zoo, named Amy, happens to have been trained in costume design on the Broadway, and she helped fabricate and sew the boot for Will. Amy designed a boot that is waterproof, fits perfectly, and was able to be held in place easily while the penguin waddles and swims about. What an amazing story! What a cool, like, usage of talents in unexpected ways. And the Cincinnati Zoo had a story along the same lines this week. Gladys, one of the gorillas at the zoo, suffered a broken humerus during a scuffle with the two younger females in her troop. The break was not a common one, so the vet team brought in surgeons from Cincinnati's Children's Hospital and anesthesiologists from the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. Along with that care, a team from GE Additive worked to create a completely custom cast they then 3D printed out of titanium. which will help it fit perfectly and also be significantly stronger than normal casts are, which is important because gorilla. I'm always so amazed by the lengths zoos go to for their animals. These stories impress me every week. And then the next few stories are follow-ups on previous things we've already talked about. So Lincoln Park Zoo has continued to share updates about Lomaloc, the young lion who we've talked about on here, who has needed a lot of help and is getting it from his incredible team. Since we last talked about it, Lomaloc took a turn for the worse, but the team was able to adjust his treatment plan and have started reintroducing him to his brothers in their indoor space and even allowing him limited yard access with his brothers because the downturn became an upturn. This story has been so awesome to follow, from the incredible care given to the low lion to the incredible transparency of the zoo every step of the way. Very cool. The gorilla introductions at Cleveland Metro Park Zoo keep progressing very well. Freddie is being an incredible surrogate mom and taking to Jamila super well, and the whole group has been together and doing just wonderfully, honestly. This story has been so great, and the training involved has been so incredible, with keepers working with gorillas, and even with gorillas working with younger gorillas to fix some behaviors. And, you know, it's such a small thing, but I also just love that the zoo does the posts about all of this as collaborative posts with the Fort Worth Zoo, which is where you may remember Jamila is from. So that, you know, that way the people who loved Jamila at the Fort Worth Zoo can follow this entire incredible story from the Fort Worth Zoo's pages without having to go and follow Cleveland Metro Parks and all that stuff. It's such a small thing, but it stands out to me, just showing how amazing the collaboration is. And that is another fun follow-up story. April 21st has come and gone, and that means that Miami Seaquarium has officially been told to shut its gates and get out of there thanks to the eviction notice sent a month ago. So, obviously, the facility is closed down now, and... oh. Wait, no, this is real life where we can't have nice things. So, as of this recording, the doors are still open and tickets are still for sale. Activists have been outside the facility protesting as they wait for the doors to close for good, but the doors aren't closing. So, what are the next steps? Well, it all comes down to the lawyers. Of course. Because America. If they are unwilling to vacate premises on their own, which is clearly the case, then the county can step in and legally force them to vacate within 7 days. Hypothetically. But, like, what happens if they don't? These aren't human tenants where you can lock the doors and threaten to keep their private property, or even like a normal business where you can just like change the locks and you know, hold on to the stuff they're selling or whatever. The dolphins and pinnipeds and such at Miami Seaquarium can't just pack up their fish and head off to another place. It's a weird situation, especially since the dolphin company technically owns those animals. The company has also filed a federal lawsuit against the county, claiming unfair targeting, restrictive zoning that hindered the facility's growth, and a breach of lease agreement. While this lawsuit, or another one they could hypothetically file in Florida, like at the state level, you know, whether that will lead to an injunction stopping the eviction while the courtroom drama plays out, it's currently unknown, but it is definitely possible. We all know how slowly the courts move. And that could, pardon the pun, give the Miami Seaquarium a new lease on life. So for now, the Seaquarium is technically evicted, but hasn't vacated or stopped doing Seaquarium things like selling tickets and, you know, functioning. And no one really knows what is next, but I'll be keeping an eye on the situation. And then whenever I find myself getting a little behind on zoo news, like when I have a special episode or whatever, I like to do a quick hits segment. So here are some quick hits from the past few weeks. Rolling Hills Zoo participated in the Deer Challenge, which stands for Drop Everything and Read. And they did so by having zookeepers read picture books to their animals. Along with the adorable photos from it, many of the animals seemed to be really interested in the enriching experience. So that's pretty cool. I like that one a lot. The Desert Museum in Arizona has announced that wild foxes in the area have been testing positive for rabies. The zoo was quick to announce that their animals are safe, but also wanted to use this as an opportunity to inform the community about the rabies and remind them that wildlife should not be handled or messed with. The Berlin Zoo recently celebrated the 67th birthday of Fatu the gorilla. He is believed to be the oldest gorilla in the entire world. Brookfield Zoo has announced that their new temporary koala habitat will be opening on May 24th, and that to celebrate, the zoo will be sharing information about their new koalas every week in May on their social media pages. So make sure you follow and then head to Chicago to check out koalas. Not koala bears, because they're not bears. I know all of you know that, but I still hear it a lot. Anyway, the Louisville Zoo is the latest facility to have to evacuate after a bomb threat was received. Police were called in, of course, and after a two-hour investigation, an all-clear was issued, with the zoo reopening at noon that day. So they only lost a few hours of open time. But the people who do this kind of thing are just disgusting. Oh, and speaking of idiots who do dumb crimes, the Columbus Zoo recently had a car stolen from its parking lot. Apparently, four masked individuals entered the parking lot and ran along the rows of cars, checking to see if cars were unlocked. When they found one that was, they boosted it. The zoo is working with the sheriff's office and will examine their security, but also, let this be a friendly reminder to lock your cars when you go to zoos. The Toronto Zoo has announced that Jita, an almost three-year-old snow leopard, is pregnant for the first time. And then, the last quick hit, the Tulsa Zoo is opening their new Elephant Preserve Barn to the public on April 24th. This is a beautiful space that is currently serving as a sort of retirement home for the three geriatric elephants that live at the zoo, but the barn, along with the Oxley Family Elephant Experience and a new 10-acre preserve, have all been built with the intention of eventually having a multi-generational elephant herd at the zoo. So that is a pretty cool commitment to elephants and to doing things well there. And then last but not least in the zoo news section, we revisit a story from Woodland Park Zoo. The zoo recently announced that Water Lily, a 45-year-old hippo who lives at the zoo, had been experiencing a decline in health after a cancer diagnosis last month. Unfortunately, the decline has been pretty rapid, and the zoo has made the decision to humanely euthanize Lily. But you'll notice I'm saying this in the future tense, and that's because the zoo recognizes how much the staff, volunteers, and guests have fallen in love with Lily, and they decided to allow guests to visit her on exhibit until April 28th, at which point the pathway will be closed and the euthanasia can take place. I love the transparency on this decision. I also love that the zoo knows Lily is doing well enough to make it a few more days without having any kind of, like, compromised, you know, living experience. Because they would not allow this if it had to be an instant decision to help her avoid suffering. But that day is coming, and this level of transparency will allow guests the privilege of going to say goodbye. It's really awesome stuff, which is, you know, what I've come to expect from Woodland Park Zoo. Sending my love to everyone at the zoo and to all of those individuals who have connected with Water Lily.
Stereotypical Animal Podcast theme song. Here to bring you to conservation news.
Mitsubishi teamed up with Bahr Technologies recently to create an incredible wind propulsion system for shipping ships. Vessels? I think vessels is a better word. Shipping ship sounds dumb. Anyway, which they are currently using on a ship called Pyxis Ocean. It's kind of incredible to see how these companies have combined modern technology with the basic idea of, you know, sails and sailing and how we used to cross the oceans, but they've created like a modern wind propulsion system. It is estimated that each shipping vessel that uses this technology can save up to 11 tons of fuel per day. And while I'm comparing them to sails, because that's, you know, basically what they are, the truth is that the new technology allows them to power modern shipping vessels, allowing things like food shipments to travel at the same speeds and on the same routes that the other ships use. But, you know, with free fuel from the wind. So, I really hope this breakthrough catches on and that it becomes more common as new shipping ships get made. The whole thing of people taking photographs with wild animals has made the news a few times recently, and shockingly, it's all really gross. So the first story about this is from Cambodia, where the government claims YouTubers torment monkeys for views so badly that they are actually planning legal action. The YouTubers in question visit the monkeys on protected lands and do things like hold baby monkeys, throw water on them, and other despicable acts, all to try to earn money from sites like YouTube and TikTok. In one video, a man literally played with the monkey's genitals in order to get it physically excited to show the camera what that looks like. Ew. Fortunately, there are laws in Cambodia that make these actions illegal, and the government is committed to going after the people making these videos. And if there's one good thing about the videos, it's that they serve as evidence of the wrongdoing. Like, as a general rule, don't do crimes. But if you're going to, don't video them and then put it out for the public to view. You know, just a thought. And, you know, I feel like a lot of these stories, when I share them, they seem far away. But a group of people in Asheville, North Carolina, recently pulled two black bear cubs out of a tree to take a selfie with them when they discovered said cubs in a tree at their apartment complex. The North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission investigated the incident, in which both bears did escape quickly, and have decided not to press charges, as it is illegal to capture and keep black bears, but these escaped immediately. Animal harassment charges could have been filed, but were not, surprising a lot of wildlife advocates. I hate this story just so much, and I hate that no charges are being filed despite concrete evidence of harassment, including the selfies and somebody who, again, was taking a video. This sets a terrible precedent for people in North Carolina to think they will get away with harassing wildlife, which is something conservationists work so hard to prevent. So here's hoping this turns out to be an isolated incident, or that the government hears from enough people and changes their mind, because it's not a double jeopardy thing. They can still, you know, press charges. Anyway, scientists have been investigating the global coral bleaching event that has been taking place for a little while now, and have determined that 54% of the world's reefs are experiencing bleaching, making this the largest bleaching event in history. The scientists believe that rising sea temperatures due to climate change, coupled with the current El Niño, is responsible for the bleaching. This is only the fourth time in recorded history that a true global coral bleaching event has happened, and while scientists have made a lot of strides on how to help combat these issues and repopulate corals, including coral banking, like we discussed from Moat Marine Lab back in early season 3, and the neat underwater speaker approach we discussed on Zoo News recently, it's really scary to see how bad this event is this time around. So here's hoping the incredible coral conservationists out there doing the work are able to help restore and repopulate these areas that are dying because of the bleaching. We often talk about invasive species and the damage they can cause, including discussing tegus earlier in this episode. Well, New Zealand went to great lengths to minimize the impact of one single animal recently, and I thought it was a fascinating story and a great conservation win. So, there is an island in New Zealand called Chalky Island, and it is a 2-square-mile bit of heaven. It is home to the Te Kakau skink. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but I like to think I am. Anyway, the spotted kiwi and the kakapo, the only parrot that can't fly and which is nearly extinct, with roughly 250 estimated remaining in the wild. The island is basically an oasis for these animals, as there are no natural predators to any of them on the land. Or there weren't until August of 2022, when a single male stoat, which is a weasel-like predator that preys on small animals and birds, and can be found in Europe, Asia, and North America, but not New Zealand, was discovered there. One stoat. And even though it was just one single animal, the country's Department of Conservation realized how big of a concern it was and launched a biosecurity response that included trapping experts, detection dogs, trail cameras, helicopters, and boats. Even with all those resources, it took the team 8 months to trap and kill the stoat and cost the country around $500,000 New Zealand dollars or around $300,000 in American dollars. And while that sounds like a lot of money for one little predator, the truth is that he could have done enough damage to entirely wipe out the kakapo population and drastically reduce those other populations, which would have been devastating. So yeah, I love the story because it was a total conservation win, but does also show just how costly invasive species can be and how even just one single invasive animal can completely wreak havoc on animals and or on government budgets. And then last but not least in conservation news this week, ABC News recently did an investigation on the plastic bag recycling bins found at many grocery stores and other such places where you can recycle your single-use plastic bags, in theory. But the findings of the study were not good. The trackers were found in all kinds of places. A bag dropped off at a Walmart in New York ended up in Indonesia. Others left at Walmarts in Kansas and Florida ended up in Malaysia. Both Indonesia and Malaysia are countries that make money by importing plastic waste from other countries to their landfills, with no attempts made at recycling the plastics. In fact, ABC News placed 19 trackers in total, and only 4 of them actually ended up at plastics recycling facilities. That is 21%, y'all, although I admit it's a small sample size. And, you know, honestly, this is one of the pushbacks I often hear, even from conservation-minded individuals that I know. I'm amazed at how many keepers and conservationists and even just people I know who donate to causes like Red Panda Network or sea turtle rescues and stuff that make no effort to get reusable bags or carry reusable straws. And when I see that and discuss it with those people, the reason why is always either something along the lines of, I see what corporations and celebrities are doing and realize that my impact is so small that it really doesn't make a difference, or I don't even think half the stuff I recycle gets recycled anyway, so what's the point? And like, honestly, I get it. Both are fair points. The fact that Taylor Swift takes her private jet downstairs from her bedroom when she needs a glass of water at night definitely has more of an impact than all the reusable bags I have purchased at zoos. It's true. But at least I am doing what I can. Now, I won't do a full rant here because y'all have heard it before, but I read stuff like this and I think this is just such a bad look. The failures on the parts of these companies, and honestly, I don't even know who is failing at this point, but it only tends to make people less invested in slightly inconveniencing themselves for the sake of our planet. But we have to. We have to. You have to be the change you want to see in this world. I just really hope that this investigation leads to these companies doing better.
It's time for other news. It's time for other news. Hey, all right now, then now it's time. It's time for other news. Hey, it's a segue to the podcast. Other news.
And in other news this week, we start with a story that I just love. Apparently, every year on April 15th, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is committed to reposting a story they posted last year, which is just a post letting people know that coyotes and badgers go on little adventures together sometimes. Apparently, the two animals will sometimes form a mutually beneficial relationship in order to get food. They team up and hunt together and are generally more successful hunting prairie dogs and ground squirrels when working together. The basic idea is that the coyote is fast enough to track down the prey if it runs from the tandem, and the badger can dig for any animals that try to burrow to escape. Then they share the food. This is adorable and makes me so happy on so many levels. I also really love that Fish and Wildlife is just like, yeah, we're sharing this every year because this is awesome. And then last but not least this week, an elephant was on the loose in Butte, not Butte, Montana this week. Seriously, an elephant. A traveling circus that was in town features elephants, and one of the elephants escaped. The circus is the Jordan World Circus, and apparently the elephant's keepers were watching her when a passing vehicle backfired, which caused her to spook and take off running across a busy street, luckily stopping traffic instead of being hit by a car. The animal returned to the circus with minimal fuss after calming down, but there is video footage of an elephant just running through Butte, again, not but, Montana. Crazy.
Animal, animal, animal holidays. Animal, animal, animal holidays.
All right, so April is Ape Awareness Month and National Frog Month. And for the week, we have April 26th, which is International Flamingo Day. And then April 27th is one of those days. It is Crow and Raven Day, and I would like to personally apologize to all other corvids for not being included, even though I do love my crows and my ravens. International Hyena Day, World Tapir Day, World Veterinary Day, National Go Birding Day, and Save the Frogs Day. Yeesh. April 28th is Pet Parents Day. April 30th is Adopt a Shelter Pet Day. Meaning if you do that, you'll have to wait almost a full year to celebrate Pet Parents Day. But that's okay. And then that brings us to May, which is National Duckling Month and National Lake Cleanup Month and No Mow May. May 1st is National Purebred Dog Day and Save the Rhino Day, which I guess it makes sense they share a day since rhinos are also called tank puppies. And May 2nd is World Tuna Day. And remember, kids, you can tune a piano, but you can't tune a fish unless it's sustainable. Why am I the way I am? All right. This was a bit of a long one, but we had a lot of catching up to do. The good news is that in the hour that I spent recording this, I'm pretty sure that the leadership of the San Francisco Zoo hasn't made any major gaffes in that entire hour. So, hey, step in the right direction. Again, love the zoo, support the zoo, just not happy with the leadership. Anyway, I would like to take this moment to say thank you to my Red Panda level patrons, Dr. Laura Schenk, Dr. Stephen Williamson, Barbara Bennett, and Jenny Owens. I'd also like to say thank you to everyone who contributed stories this week, including Anya Keene, Colleen Lenihan, Kim Cooley Croninger, Carrie Kirkpatrick, Kevin Williams, Rob Wright, Emily Rockbuck, Dr. Laura Schenk, Kristen Dickey, Ali Malensky, K. Malensky, The Malenskys. I don't know. I never know. Matt Patford, Megan Belanger. Belanger? Probably Bellinger. I don't know. I should ask. Anyway, Elizabeth Charles, Sam Evans, Michael Sebastian, Anne Yoshioka, Dr. Zoe Rossi, Becca Robinson, Kristen Khalil, Jess Wells, Nora Beardsley, Rowena White, Allie Joy, Melissa Reed, Jacob Zinn, Anna Mick-Ick-Rin. Okay, so it's spelled differently, and she sent me a pronunciation, and it's McEchran, obviously, but she explained it as Mick-Eck-Rin, and we like to have fun in this section. So, Anna McEchran, or Anna Mick-Eck-Rin, and Sherry Weiss, thank you all so much. And for those of you who I, like, joke around with your names, please know that it comes from a place of love and keep sending me stories because I love you all. As a matter of fact, I love you all so much that I'm going to take the time now to remind you that the words Newsy Credits Backwards are Steiderk Yeswen.
The Ross Safari Podcast is produced, hosted, and engineered by John Rossi. Editing and fact-checking by John and Dr. Zoe Rossi. Our theme song is Sevens by Nathan Burke, performed by Nathan and John. interrupting John theme and additional voices by Taylor Isaac Gray. You can reach John directly on Instagram and Facebook at Rossafari or by email at rossafaripod@gmail.com. Rossafari is part of the Daydreamer Media Network. Now, stop listening to me and go visit a zoo.